Alrighty, and welcome all, welcome all. We are dissecting yet another beloved film score composer. And with me to make sense of this ginormous, splendid mess, it is David Rosen. How are you, sir?
I'm all right, and this is a big one.
Howard
as far as
Shore,
composers, yeah, there's so much.
Level. Giant, enormous collaborator with the likes of Martin Scorsese, David Cronenberg, Martin Campbell, Jonathan Demme, David Fincher, and most notably, Peter freaking Jackson. Yes, Mr. Shore is part of so many music groups. Including, I think it was Soundwave was his group, I think. And
yes, I listened to, like, in the lead up to this, I listened to so many of his scores that I didn't get a chance to dig into his own, like, other kinds of music. I was listening, like, exclusively to scores because there's just so many of them.
Yeah, there's too much to dissect for this long running career.
Yeah.
So no, the group was Lighthouse, and they've been around since the 70s. Just
okay.
Actually, yeah, 1968, and they were a just pop rock band that was big in Ontario. But yeah, Mr. Shore was born in Canada in 1946 and developed a classical appreciation, and he was also a music director, and, you know, being how Lorne Michaels is also a Canadian, you know, he got in on his radar and he hired him to be the original Saturday Night Live opening score, as well as the iconic score that you hear at the beginning of Conan O'Brien's various talk shows. So
sure.
Yeah. He supervised all kinds of music soundtracks in addition to all these film scores and composing. And it's pretty unreal, because usually it's just like one or the other. You don't see them do all this stuff all at once.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a wide range, and it's not just a lot of films and a lot of projects, but such a wide range of sounds and styles. Like the idea that the guy that made that Conan O'Brien theme would make things like Crimes of the Future last year.
Yes.
It's ridiculous.
Still pretty loyal to Cronenberg, always working with the man. He's,
yeah.
But yeah, his Lord of the Rings score was, what's funny is I didn't know who did that right away, but I was very much taken back by it, because of course it's epic freaking music, which is what that movie trilogy needs. Of course, they wanted to pay tribute to it so much. So when the recent Rings of Power show came out, they decided to use his main theme as their main theme song for that show, even though it's a different canon, let alone paying tribute and doing its own, like, takeaway. It's complicated, guys, but it's pretty cool. But yeah, altogether, I mean, this man is just, when you feel it, you really do with a lot of these deep listens, because altogether, I mean, it's just very intriguing just hearing, again, just someone who not only is evolving, but also just really just going for different kinds of drama, because there's some who stick with just the epic or just the low-key comedic.
Right.
This guy fleshes out his own material for his own kind of formulas, instead of just being the billionth, you know, Hans Zimmer, John Williams inspired.
Sure.
Bernard Herrmann, if you want to go that far. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's like, I feel like, I don't know what, like, direction you want to go as far as, like, how I mean, going through his career, like, doing so many different things, but, like, I feel like you could trace it through Cronenberg because of, I mean, 18 collaborations with him.
Yeah, he's definitely the main MVP in this whole
giant. It's like, yeah, even with all of those, you know, all those things. And it's funny too, because you know, and not to make the conversation about Cronenberg, which, by the way, it's his birthday today. I just happened to see.
Right. Yeah, so. We are coincidentally, as much planning as we did, we never counted on it being his 80th birthday when we recorded.
Totally random. So that's cool. But yeah, even just in his collaborations with Cronenberg, you get that wide range of sounds and styles, like from just like totally classic inspired, like film score stuff to like very heavily electronic and, you know, even industrial and synth based sounds. And so it's like, even just with that one director, you get such a wide range of sounds. And then of course, with everything else, with Scorsese or, you know, whoever else he's working
with. Yeah, the Scorsese's, I take it back. Those might be the better known ones.
Possibly. I don't know. I think Lord of the Rings is like the, I think if you were to like, you know, go to just people who aren't like hardcore film score nerds or anything like that, like people that just love movies or whatever, like I think that might be the score that they've listened to on its own outside of the film.
1000%. 1000 freaking percent. And
yeah,
good on you though for mentioning the Scorsese ones, because like those are the ones where they kind of just remind the viewer to think. Because like there's other ones that he talks about where, or that were kind of just, again, all about just certain kind of rhythm, like especially with his Cronenberg ones, especially in The Fly. And altogether, I mean, would you say he's harder on his trumpets or kind of more relies on the bass and acoustics and other stuff?
It's so hard to say because of that wide range. I mean, it's, I mean, you definitely get a lot of those trumpets along in a lot of these scores. I mean, I think there was a lot of that in Hugo, and you know, there's like just it's just so hard to say though to nail them down to any one particular thing because of that wide range. You know what I mean? So it's like it's difficult to approach it talking about any particular instrumentation or styles with him. I mean back to Lord of the Rings, I mean it's everything. It's like just the biggest, most epic type of score you can get, and whatever's necessary to bring out that, you know, grandeur of those movies, he's able to do it. Even though maybe if you like, you know, came to Howard Shore as somebody who doesn't like know much about like the other work he's done, I mean, you might hear one of the Cronenberg films and think he's more of a synth guy and couldn't even orchestrate like that, you know? So it's very interesting. And I'm a composer myself, and it's inspiring to be able to do that big of a range, you know?
Very nice. Altogether, would he make your top 10 composers? Or just maybe top 20, 100?
It's funny, when we first talked about doing this, I don't think I would have had him in my top 10. But after listening to some of these, it's like now I'm definitely considering it, you know, at least top 20. But yeah, there's some really great stuff here, you know, in re-listening to some of these scores. I don't know, other than Lord of the Rings, if there's any of them that I had ever listened to like on their own before, like without the film.
And probably The Fly. I mean, that one's...
Yeah, The Fly I probably had at some point for sure. But yeah, otherwise, I don't think there was. My favorite, I guess, if you want to like jump into that, like the one that like kind of stood out to me that I was surprised at how much I loved it was Spotlight, the 2015 film, which to me was just not only just beautiful, but just so cool and like interesting in the way that it would like... You know, because that film, you
good
know,
use of piano.
Yeah, a bit great use of piano and like those arpeggiated guitars, and like it's just, it really keeps a film like that exciting. And I think a big part of what makes that film work is the score. Now that I'm like kind of listening to it on its own and like kind of thinking back to what makes that film work, it's like it keeps you, you know, on your toes as to like what's going to happen, and you know, are these reporters going to be able to pull this whole thing off?
Good point. Yeah, because, you know, not everyone can do the exact same kind of material each and every time. So it is interesting to see them keep challenging themselves, even when you think they're getting just too comfortable.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I also had you know, I already brought it up, but Crimes of the Future. We did a top 10 scores of the year episode last year on Piecing It Together, and that made my top 10 list. So, you know, it's such a cool score, and it's kind of industrial in a way, and like just really just like raw, and so many like electronic elements that, again, it's just like that totally other end of the spectrum. And I think it's just super memorable and unique for not only for him, but just as a film score in general.
1000%. Altogether, so the Lord of the Rings scores are just interesting in that they use a big mix of just kind of straightforward horns as opposed to the blaring trumpets. But it's interesting how when he gets into melodies, he kind of leaves it for more quieter moments in that otherwise pretty loud, you know, epic.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. You still have to go epic. You still, you know, yeah, he's not into the, like the, you know, the Zimmer, you know, Brahm stuff, but yeah, he's not going there, yeah. But he totally could if he wanted to, but he gets it to be big in other ways. And then, yeah, he saves the melody for when it counts, and to make it, you know, to make it all kind of tie together with the, you know, the journey of the hobbits and all that stuff. And, yeah, I mean, it's an incredible score. And like the fact that it all feels fresh through all of those movies, it's like a lot of runtime and a lot of music, but it keeps being great along all of it.
1000, 1000, 1000. Altogether, I think just about all his music's been released. I couldn't find any shows where it was very apparent that, yeah, no, that's not ever getting a release ever.
Well, okay, so is there a leak or something of the King Kong score that he didn't end up doing? Because that was something that I was wondering as I was like,
oh yeah, I didn't think about that.
that's something I was thinking about when we were like first talking about doing this. I was like, oh okay, I've never sat down and listened to his unused King Kong score, and I know it's out there, but then I went to look and it's not out there. I don't think it was ever released or leaked in any way. There's some fake YouTube uploads, but it turns out that they're all fake and it's not really the music. They're just
people having fun. Yeah,
exactly. So now I'm wondering, like, really, like, is there a way to hear any of that? And, you know, what is the story with it? And are we ever going to get to hear it? Because, I mean, I'm a huge King Kong fan. And, I mean, you know, James Newton Howard did a great job with the score. You know, I love that movie and everything about it. But you have to wonder, you know, what another Peter Jackson collaboration like that would be, and especially with that kind of a character, King Kong.
I know the OneRing.com has some unreleased rarities, but those are just exclusives, like variations of his different tracks that he performs live.
Okay.
At the various Lord of the Rings shows, but yeah, that's as close as I can get to. That's, I know last year they said unused parts of his score for Videodrome was to be released.
Oh, that'll be cool.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah. But no, that is a good point, because kind of like even Randy Newman, of all people, he's had a bunch of movies where it's like he was attached and then either the filmmakers disagreed with what he was utilizing, or it just utter creative differences.
Yeah.
They're like, we're just not going to use it. Nothing personal, but we're just not using it. But
yeah,
I do find it interesting how he has even scored on occasion just other just low-key dramas that you don't really think of someone of his ilk often doing, like comedies like She-Devil and, you know, even Big and Moving, which is kind of a sleeper for Richard Pryor, as well as Places in the Heart, the period drama. So
sure, yeah, all kinds of stuff.
So much to process, because you're just like, what? Yeah, yeah, probably the only movie that like even he's forgotten he worked on is Nothing Lasts Forever. And no, that doesn't have anything to do with the Die Hard novel. That has to do with a movie that's made the rounds on many good movies that were lost either because A, the distributor never made it commercially available, and it's only been seen on rare, like, Turner Classic Movies airings, and B, it's, again, it's just a lost movie. No one's doing anything. So
I didn't know about that. Yeah, that is interesting. I wonder.
Yeah, it has Bill Murray, and it's a I don't really know what it's about, even after reading about it. It's but because it's a lost movie, that alone just makes people just, you know, sit up and go, how can I find it?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if it'll ever see the light of the day. Hopefully. It would be interesting to see.
Totally. What mood do you think is pretty key? Because, like, he kind of focuses mainly on just people turning to the dark side or making an unexpected move that's, you know, like, illegal or totally just, like, unexpected. He's all about the surprises, kind of, and incorporating that into his scores.
Definitely. Like, yeah, like, even though we're talking about, like, such a wide range of stuff, I mean, it does seem... If he's done like 100 films, which it seems like he's done at least 100 films,
at least,
like, probably like 80% of them are darker stuff. Even like Silence of the Lambs and Seven and stuff like that. So, like, yeah, I mean, I think Mysterious and the dark stuff, like, definitely is probably where he loves to work, but then he's probably cool with working in all different kinds of areas, which. That's kind of how I am, actually, as a composer. Like, the majority of what I do is in dark stuff, thrillers and mysterious stuff and horror.
It's just
and
more interesting.
Like, yeah, I just enjoy doing it. It's interesting. It's fun. And I just like how it sounds. So, you know, it's definitely a fun place to work in. But yeah, I mean, he does so many different things here. God, he did Dogma? Like, what?
You're right. It's like...
That's random.
So wild, man. So wild. Altogether, I mean, I wish any other composer had this diverse resume. Because, like,
yeah,
there's some sleeper films on here too. Because, like, for all the psycho thrillers, he's got like A Kiss Before Dying, Single White Female, Seven. He's got comedies again, like Nobody's Fool, Ed Wood, Miss Doubtfire, and just so many other just hits. And then just continuously going back to working with Barbet Schroeder, even Al Pacino for some of his dramedies. And
yeah,
and then going back to what he's better known for, which is Fincher, Jackson, and just all the other Cronenberg productions. I think, really, I'm not all that disappointed by too many of his pickings. I haven't seen the one Scorsese short film made in Milan, but it's and I kind of don't really remember the score for Postcards from the Edge, but that's just because the movie's very involving. So and they're in there, you know, here and there, to where it's like you'll pick them out when you want to pick them out.
Sure.
And to build on your earlier point, it does seem like he hasn't released any of his unused scores. He had one that was for Ron Howard's Ransom, and he got replaced by James Horner. And I don't know if the Copland soundtrack ever really got released all that big.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I don't remember anything about Striptease, and that's probably for the better, but except for the obvious moments, you know what they are. But it's interesting how he's got, because after you said, like, Dogma is like, then the 2000s take a total twist where he just opens up that roster to work with all these newcomers and other big names that we're just getting their big start doing directing work, and you're just like, wow, okay.
I was just scrolling through his IMDb, and in 96 he did 6 films, which, that's insane. But the fact that two of them are That Thing You Do, which is about as bright and bubbly as you could possibly imagine, and then another one is David Cronenberg's Crash.
very impactful.
What a range. Oh my god, that's crazy. I could just imagine like jumping back and forth between those two projects. Like, wow.
Yeah, and I couldn't really find as many interviews. Obviously, years ago, I saw the Lord of the Rings special features, and he was on there a bunch working closely with Jackson. But I mean, yeah, I mean, 96 is definitely the big year. I mean, 94, he scored The Client for Joel Schumacher, and I do kind of recall that one having a nice melody, but it's kind of a typical score that you often see used in Southern dramas, let alone legal movies, but it's still kind of like Philadelphia. He was able to kind of surprise me here and there a bit, where you're like, whoa, I didn't expect the score to make that cue that early. So he does kind of find little small snippets, little small edits he can make that allow the score to be even more commanding. The first time I ever heard him actually speak in an interview was years ago. This is how long ago we're going back into the den, but I remember him in 05 being interviewed on NPR to describe a history of violence.
We'll return after these messages.
Hello and welcome to Culture Shocked, the pop culture podcast brought to you by four aging millennials and our outdated opinions. Join us every Tuesday as we discuss movies, TV, games, and even music, new and old.
Dude, what do you think you're doing?
Are you seriously trying to record a promo without us right now?
Well, yeah.
Dude, you can't just do the promo by yourself. Who's going to listen to that?
Yeah, and you probably haven't even told them that we're a pop culture podcast where we always agree on everything. For instance, the Sam Raimi trilogy easily being the best of the Spider-Man movies.
No. But I think we can all agree that Jaws is a classical masterpiece.
Nope, don't like that. But we do all agree that the sequel trilogy of Star Wars is the best in the Skywalker saga, right, guys?
That comment is so ridiculous. I don't even know where to
Anyways, that'll do it from all of us here at Culture Shock. Thanks for listening.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR, we add them to our queues, we wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan. We're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode, we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
Run all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
I remember him just being just very deep in that. He just was like, hey, you know, I already worked for New Line, and I love writing music, especially for my main star, Viggo Mortensen, and it was the same kind of deal. It was like, in this version, you know, of a character this beloved actor's playing, I gotta illustrate the various secrets and everything that this character is just now unveiling, and you know, and but I want to compliment the performance. And I thought that was cool to hear, because you do hear some people, but often at the end of it, all you get is me, 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 me. Right. So it was cool to hear someone say, hey, I still want to make an impact without leaving a dent.
Yeah.
Distract.
Yeah, you really need to have that attitude going into it. Like, you know, and whenever I'm working on a film, like, you know, as much as I want to, you know, show off and do something interesting with the music, like, no, rule number one is to compliment the film and to support it and to make sure that the film is doing what it needs to be doing. So it's clear that he cares and is trying to do that first and foremost.
Nice. What would you say is your favorite instrument to utilize the most in your work?
I like using a lot of synth. I'm definitely that kind of a composer. I use, you know, a lot of keyboards and a lot of synth sounds, and I do tend to work in heavier synth based scores. And so, you know, definitely some of that Cronenberg stuff that he's done has, you know, inspired me in ways. But yeah, I mean, I like using some guitar as well. And, you know, of course, string instruments and stuff, which are always going to be found in most scores. But everything, whatever is going to make that scene, you know, what it feels like it needs to be, that's where mm-hmm. I usually head. And but yeah, I do love working with synth based stuff. Like, that's kind of where I come from as a musician.
Nice. And yeah, just finding your style and your signature after all that experimentation, it doesn't get any easier. I'm back to shore. I'm just blown away by how many, again, just like other international productions he's done that I have never heard of. It's like, where was I?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, yeah, 100.
He has this French movie about a Native American veteran forming a friendship with a French psychoanalyst that stars Benicio del Toro. I've never heard of this movie at all.
And what's it called?
It's called like Jimmy P. Psychotherapy of a Plains Indian, 2013. I've never heard of this. I'm like, how have I? Usually, I hear about anything, even if it's a simple Variety or Hollywood Reporter article. I take note and.
Yeah, I never heard of this one either.
Yeah, absolutely. It's 2010s, though. It's kind of a blur, but like, other than his, again, just doing the usual helping out with Cronenberg and returning for the Hobbit trilogy, I think what you said earlier, the Spotlight score was well deserved. I definitely remember the Hugo and Rosewater ones being pretty effective.
Yeah, the Aviator too.
Aviator.
And Doubt was another one that I really liked.
That was definitely one where I saw it in a film studies class, and it's just so good to do it there, because that at that point you're getting a mixture of some kind of theater experience. You know, people turn the lights off, you know.
Yeah.
You're paying attention to all the dialogue and character intent a little more, especially because not only is it only, you know, for a grade, but you're also just wanting to just, you know, study.
Yeah. I got to rewatch that movie sometime soon. That was my favorite movie of 2008. And I haven't seen it since the theater. But yeah,
I just find that it holds up. It's
I bet.
Very impactful. It's just not much like Spotlight. It's not an easy to market movie. And then I think more people like it than they let on. They just don't talk about it as much because it is, you know, heavy subject matter. And
sure.
But it's, I'll be damned if it's not intriguing. And you know, just I did hear, I see the Pale Blue Eye, and that score definitely left a cool impression, because kind of like Seven, he was kind of going into just kind of the dark realm, giving you an idea of how anyone could probably be the killer here in this unusual mystery. And then kind of like The Catcher was a spy, he kind of goes for a more kind of quieter melody, and much like The Aviator, he kind of has a few dings here and there to just kind of remind you, hey, you know, I'm adding life to it, but this actually happened.
right, absolutely.
This is a real deal. This isn't just some big Hollywood blockbuster and the names are changed.
Now that I think about it, the Pale Blue Eye, yeah, because I watched that just at the beginning of the year. I didn't love it, but I'm remembering now that probably the score is my favorite part about it. So
it is one of those like or hate it movies. I think a lot of people were disappointed because it was part mystery, part horror, and it delivered on the mystery, but it didn't deliver on the horror. So it's just like, well, what the hell?
That's fair. Yeah, I think that's definitely fair.
I found out he has a son named Ryan, who actually a nephew, my bad, but big difference, my bad, guys. But he has done a lot of scoring of cartoons and video games.
I wonder if he'll even work occasional with TV. I wonder if he'll work with Brandon Cronenberg at some point.
There you go.
Yeah.
Like father, like son.
Or cousin.
Perfect. Yeah. I really don't have any complaints about them. He's picked some pretty big projects that you can see totally why people keep using him. He's either able to just really dial it anywhere, go anywhere the wind blows or something, but it's hard to describe. Other than his piano, what are some of the big instruments? I know he's credited as using a saxophone and flute. I don't really recall those as much. I definitely can make out an occasional clarinet, I think, in Hugo.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, Hugo's a very playful score, which is a little different from a lot of his other stuff. It reminded me a lot of Alexander Desplat, his scores, like his Wes Anderson stuff and things like that. But it's definitely a little bit different from a lot of his other stuff. But like we talked about, like he does such a wide range that like it's like, is anything really different than anything with Howard Shore? It's like everything is so different. There's so many genres like and styles that he's working in. So but yeah, Hugo definitely is, I guess, a little bit of an outlier in that way.
1000%. I guess just because if it's just so unexpected for everybody, like no one expected, you know, Scorsese to make a playful movie, let alone just kind of a fantasy film that still had, you know, it could be grim without being morbid. And adults liked it because they kind of got lost in kind of the, I don't know how I would describe that movie either, you know, because like Spielberg will take kind of a cue from Frank Capra. I don't really know where Scorsese goes other than like Fellini or Godard type, you know.
You're sure.
Yeah. French New Wave.
Yeah.
Old Italian art house movies. So, I mean, yeah. But it's definitely a movie that like was just a rare crowd pleaser. Like kids and adults dug it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And regardless of whatever inspired him, that movie inspired a lot of movies this past year with all the Power of Cinema movies that we've been getting, from The Fablemans to Empire of Light and all these other ones.
So many.
It's definitely been a moment for those kind of things.
Yeah, it's been pretty good about that. It's also just kind of a rarity, because usually when we, you know, actually want to build up to these and describe some of these movies, they're still at the end of the day kind of for a specific audience. We're seeing some adults be cynical about superhero movies, and we're seeing some kids movies not be all that agreeable for every crowd, like only for like six and up, and you know, and so it's with certain restrictions and certain preferences and people getting pickier about what they like, it's just so cool to see someone who can kind of progress and just find something that interests just about most people.
Yeah. And if nothing else, who doesn't like David Cronenberg?
Yeah. Well, let's just not talk to any of the haters.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, man. I saw that he worked a lot with, on occasion, with Michael Lehman, and there's someone who I was not familiar with, but who's pretty big on doing dark comedies like Airheads and Heathers, and I'm like, geez, so this guy worked with another Cronenberg collaborator, and that kind of makes sense because same kind of movies where it's like, I need you to help illustrate something odd that I'm willing to, you know, explain on set. And I think if anything, Howard Shore is just a fearless composer, much like the many people he surrounds himself with, like just like Jackson and Cronenberg and even Fincher went from being pretty low budget and like music videos and documentaries and horror comedies and are now doing more mainstream sci-fi horror and even dramas. It's just wild how this man is also just another, it's just like he started off in TV and Cronenberg's lower budget, and now he's still working 4 decades later, you know, doing bigger material. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Cronenberg has taken an interesting, you know, turn in the 2000s, just going into mostly drama type stuff. But now, of course, Crimes of the Future, getting back into the weird stuff. So, yeah, I mean, definitely he seems to surround himself with those kinds of filmmakers. And I hope he does something with Peter Jackson again at some point. I hope Peter Jackson does something again at some point. It's been forever since he's done a narrative film. The guy is
so good at tiring himself out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's got to do another feature at some point. And I would love to hear what Howard Shore would cook up. You know, I don't know. I guess we'll see. Hopefully it's not just another Lord of the Rings, though.
We'll see. We shall see. Altogether, I mean, since this is just another guy who's just like, we have pretty much covered most of his stuff surprisingly very quick. If you were gonna tell a beginner to just like get into him, like what are you gonna definitely recommend the most, like must be listened to by any fan of cinema music?
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd have to start with Lord of the Rings just because it's so big. It's such a big presence in, you know, the last 30, 40, 50 years of film. But then, you know, just because of my recent re-listen, I would tell people to check out Spotlight just because of how much I loved that. And then you have to at least include one or two Cronenberg movies just because they've had such...
Totally.
A big collaboration over the years.
Maybe.
Yeah, that would be a good one. Go back to The Fly. Or like I said, I really loved Crimes of the Future last year. So that's a good one to include as well.
If you're going to do one-offs that are just occasional, like helping out, I don't know if it is. I take it back. I actually don't know if the score is commercially available. I would think it would be since it was kind of a big movie in its day. But I think An Innocent Man might appeal. I actually recall even the script for the score for Sliver actually being pretty good, but Guilty as Sin is actually pretty impactful and is surprisingly pretty blaring loud for a Sidney Lumet film.
Nice. I'll have to check that one out. I didn't
usually
listen to that one.
More kind of quieter, like suspenseful. So.
Sure. I'll have to check that out. Yeah,
I haven't seen Ed Wood in a while, but I have no doubt that the score was pretty diverse for that one. But it's helpful that he chose a lot of movies that have hard to discuss themes, and he's just kind of he's helping the not only the filmmakers flesh it out, but also kind of just helps them extra focus on just kind of the bizarreness of their scenarios. Nice. And I applaud him for that because not everyone can do that, you know. Some scores just only distance the audience more and some help, but the filmmaking may not be the best, so you know, if you can't get it 100%, then it's gonna just frustrate everybody.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I mean, I applaud all of his various collaborations because like some of them are just kind of just quieter movies that because like you said, 96 was he's actually kind of tied with a lot of actors we've covered on here, from Angelina Jolie to Antonio Banderas, to just like just people is like they're just mid-90s, they were at their peak. They were everyone finally knew who their name was in town.
Yeah, just work. They got in and then they just worked.
1000%. And I mean, even just, I mean, the racial drama, White Man's Burden, the parents looking after their troubled kid before and after, and even a bunch of romantic comedies like Moonlight and Valentino and The Truth About Cats and Dogs. It's like, see, this is, again, much like that thing you do, is like, that is awesome to be doing that kind of serious, energetic, and reminding people to laugh in addition to all these dark character studies. It's just like, I think I knew someone who even had David Fincher's The Game score somewhere. But that was kind of where Shore kind of took a turn and kind of experimented with some occasional electronic in both this and Existence and current Cronenberg. So, I mean, good on him for a guy who just kind of wants to kind of just both, you know, do his typical signature and then just surprise you in just a way where you not only don't know how he did it, but you kind of, he's kind of like the magician. I want to kind of have him keep to his tools. He's doing it so well, I don't want to know the magic.
Sure, absolutely.
Which is so weird, because usually we're trying to always, you know, break it down. I mean, you do it on your show where you actually, you know, you actually try to figure out, you know, why are fanboys being toxic? Why are people being so over the top about what's meant to be straightforward entertainment, you know? He's been in part of, I mean, he's done a few recent Indian features, some which are even on Netflix. There's one called Funny Boy, and I'm like, well, I not only want to see it as a fan of your work, I just want to see it in general, because it sounds like a movie that everybody did. They all thought it was an important story to tell, and to see that actually illustrated, that, I mean, I gotta applaud that, because it's already hard as it is to just explain, just like sell your movie and get it made.
Sure.
And actually just like, hey, I trust you, you know, as more than just a collaborator, but as a peer who watches your work, I'm sure it meant something.
Right. Yeah.
Instead of, okay, you know, this was this period where your passion was on screen and the rest were, you know, a payday. And don't get me wrong, there's plenty of paydays where we like and they disown, but unfortunately I haven't seen him do that. He might have done it with anything he got fired from, but you know, who wouldn't?
Yeah, hopefully. I would hope I would get paid still.
Oh, I'm sure he got paid. I'm just meaning he probably got annoyed. He's like, what the hell, dude?
Yeah,
absolutely. What don't you like about it?
Yep, absolutely.
But yeah, every interview he's in, he seems to really properly even explain what went into it, and the fact that he even supervised a play and live orchestra in Germany that was based on The Fly is just already awesome.
Yeah, that is pretty damn cool. I would love to I would love to see if there's any video of that or anything. That would be kind of cool to see. The only interview with him that I've ever seen, there was one I watched the other day with him and Cronenberg, actually talking about their collaborations and just,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was fun. It was only like 5 minutes long or something. It was on YouTube, but it was at some film festival, but they basically talked about how, like, at this point, they don't really need to talk that much about what they want out of the score. Like, they just, you know, have an understanding of the direction that each other's going. And that's such a gift. Like, when you've worked with someone that much, that, you know, you could trust each other to know that you're going to be on the same page. And yeah, it's really cool when those kind of collaborations work out.
Yeah. Just the kind of just rarity that, and I believe it, because Rogue Commentary did release a recent commentary track, which for one of Cronenberg's movies, which happens to be History of Violence, and they always talk with someone who's worked on said movie to make their own unofficial score, and sometimes it's actually used for, in particular, even in the UK, as a Blu-ray commentary track. They're doing such good work, and History of Violence, the screenwriter was pretty much outlining that at first everybody was unsure. They just were all just very unsure with all the talent they had at first, and then they kind of all started getting comfortable with each other, and then along the way realizing, we got a different take on this, but we're literally all saying the same thing, just differently.
Nice.
We just got to sit down and listen.
Yeah, absolutely.
I saw that he narrated a film composing documentary for like Canadian radio called Into the Music, and that's cool to hear, because there's nothing worse than when you kind of just see a cool documentary but very basic or uninvolving questions. So that's cool that he decided, hey, I'm gonna narrate this, I'm I'm part of this industry, so I'll speak about it. And
yeah, I'd like to see that. Yeah,
1000%. I hope that's on YouTube, but I don't know for sure, actually. But you brought up the Dogma score. I actually don't really remember as much of the music Dogma, but
yeah,
I do recall there being some dramatic cues that were both kind of illustrating some of the, you know, scenes that aren't funny but are reminding the audience, hey, it's all for laughs. So I thought that was... I think it's definitely more apparent when the characters in that movie become angels and they're fighting. Is like, see, that's why he did so good at it, is because he's already done other comedies, so he can bend the various genre rules.
Sure. Absolutely.
Sure. So, Dave, man, you you busted this open and made it implode with joy. So what do you... got coming up next on Piercing It Together? I did see that you did do a recent episode on Creed 3.
Yeah, Creed 3 was our most recent episode. I actually had the CEO of MoviePass as my guest on that one, which mm-hmm. is just a random opportunity.
Semi big names is like, man.
Yeah. Just interesting people. I love, you know, talking to people about movies. And yeah, for anyone who hasn't listened to Piecing It Together before, we take a look at a movie through the lens of what other movies might have inspired it. And it's just a fun, different way to approach talking about a movie. And we've got plenty of episodes on the way. Just recorded one on 65. And I've got I've got a bunch. Like, I don't even know. I just keep recording. It just never ends. I'm hoping to do some more live shows too, actually, which that's what I'm kind of in the middle of planning right now. We just did one last month on Cocaine Bear, where it was like in the theater. And it was a really fun time. And so, yeah, I'm planning some more live shows coming up soon. But aside from that, you know, I'll be covering all the major movies as well as many of the indie films as I can. And yeah, lots of episodes on the way, and also recently released a new album under my name, David Rosen, called More Content, which is available wherever you can find music. And I'm Sweet. Working on another album right now and scoring another film right now. So just staying busy.
That's badass. Altogether, I mean, I've heard you also work with Sean on the I Must Break This podcast, you know. Yeah. So it's so cool to hear you just kind of, again, see you make time for all these multiple, you know, guest spots in addition to all these giant guests, and you're, you know, hosting the show and keeping current. I don't know how you do it, but you,
yeah, it's a lot of time, but what can I say? I love talking about movies with cool people.
I applaud you though too for just kind of, again, like you say, you want to make sense of it all.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to figure it out. Inspiration
is hard because, yeah, you, half the time the filmmakers don't remember what movie was inspired by what, or whether it's they might have been only part of the, you know, one office chat, but they weren't part of the actual, you know, writing process or marketing department, and it's just so many people who you pretty much have to talk to before you can make sense of, okay, well, I think this filmmaker is a little, you know, full of themselves here versus no, they got a good point here. Of course it was, you can see the influence picking the same cinematographer or one of the same writers, you know, of course they got some of the same themes.
Yeah, absolutely. Every movie is inspired by another movie. And, you know, to me, it's always a good thing. Like some people will hear the concept of piecing it together and just be like, oh yeah, there's no original ideas anymore. And I'm like, no, that's not the point.
It's bad. It's just, yeah. But it's just hard.
That's storytelling. You know, that's all what storytelling is. It's, you know, we're all drawing from the same kinds of stories and we're all exploring the same kinds of ideas with different kinds of stories. And so, things have to be inspired by other things. And, you know, especially when we get to take one movie as a jumping off point to talk about all those other insane and awesome and cool and unique and just interesting movies. It's a fun way to talk, you know?
Very much fun. So fun. Well, been a delight having you on here, my sir. And you were just good at just, again, you know, you get everyone just so comfortable.
Well, hopefully we can get you on Piecing It Together one of these days.
I'm down. I have heard of the podcast actually a lot. When you were breaking down Dark Fate, I mean, I remember you had a cool guest on there who was just like, everybody get over themselves.
Nice.
And you also just, again, you're all about the constructivity of it all. And I think so many podcasts kind of like to, good or bad, they like to kind of play into kind of just the making fun of the internet or snobs attacking other snobs. And it's like, no, let's have an actual conversation. Cause I think at the end of the day, everyone actually wants to hear about a movie's merit, you know, and unfortunately you are going to get some, well, I don't know about unfortunate, but you're going to get some that are a little in between and just, you can't find a agreeable method to the movie. But like you say, you do always try to start it off and it's like, okay, so who was this marketed for versus who actually showed up and embraced it or disowned it, and is it still embraced or disowned to this day, or is it taking a turn?
Absolutely, yeah, there's always some seed of a good idea there, but it doesn't always work out, but you know, at least we could approach it from that good place.
Yeah. As far as I know, I mean, is there a bad place? But yeah, great having you on here. And I hope you're not getting into any predicaments or other crazy stuff that's just like also taking up your time. That's annoying.
Nah, there's always something, but you know, we keep on moving on, right?
Keep on moving on. You can do it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Anytime, anytime.
On the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jacked up.